Presentation is by Dr. John Santelli. He's a professor and chair of the Heilbrun Department of Population and Family Health at the School of Public Health at Columbia University and a senior fellow at the Guttmacher Institute. John's a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist.
Thank you, Erica.
I'd like to acknowledge my non-co-author, Ava Barber, who did all the legal research on this paper. And I have no relationships, abstinent or otherwise, to disclose. And I'm not sure what off-label use of abstinence would be, but I'd like to learn more. There are many paths to the truth or to accuracy. This is Stephen Colbert's. In order to maintain an untenable position, you have to be actively ignorant. My motto on this show is keep your facts. I'm going with the truth. Okay. Anyway. Let me cover a little bit about the federal program. Abstinence only until marriage and abstinence promotion has really emerged as the U.S. government's primary strategy for dealing with adolescent sexuality in the last 10 years. By 2005, it's estimated there'd be going to be more than 800 programs promoting abstinence only and about $1.5 billion spent. And I think increasingly professionals, parents, and policymakers are raising concern about it. There was a major expansion of federal support for abstinence only in 1996. Actually, abstinence only until marriage funding comes in three flavors. There's the Adolescent Family Life Act, which has been around since 1981, but was a small program, but was probably formative in producing the later versions. Section 510, which funds states, which started as part of welfare reform, and the funding started in 98. And the CBAE program, the Community-Based Abstinence Education Program, which provides funds directly to community-based and faith-based organizations. Importantly, the federal program talks about the exclusive purpose, the promotion of abstinence outside of marriage. And importantly, programs, recipients of the federal funds may not in any way advocate contraceptive use or even discuss contraceptive methods except to emphasize their failure rate. So one can talk about failure of condoms, that the condom, you might get pregnant or you might get an STD, but you can't mention the fact that they might prevent those outcomes. And there are a broad variety of critiques, and we're not going to be able to cover all of these today, but that they're poorly designed, that's really a moral agenda, that they withhold life-saving information for youth, that they're unresponsive to GLBTQ. In my discussion of medical accuracy today, I'll try to comment on some of these, though. Okay. So what's the issue on medical accuracy? Okay. There was an important report in 2004 from, at that time, the minority subcommittee, Henry Waxman's subcommittee, and they reviewed the commonly used curricula used in the federal program, and they found major errors and distortions of public health information in 11 to 13 programs, false information about contraception, risk of abortion, other scientific errors. One of the programs couldn't get the number of chromosomes right. And importantly, they often treated stereotypes, you know, the sort of Ozzie and Harriet 50s family is sort of scientific fact. There's also some other early critiques, one of which was around censorship of textbooks and teachers. So in Texas, they took information about contraception out of the health textbooks. There's also been a number of surveys tracking changes in sexuality education over time. So we see surveys of teachers, school superintendents, and young people, and they all suggest that teaching about contraception has declined, and abstinence teaching is now much higher than teaching about contraception. And Cynthia actually talked about some of the. We now have requirements in the Title X program for counseling about abstinence. It's shown up in HIV programs, and those of you who work internationally know it's shown up in the PEPFAR program. Okay. These were three pamphlets that I picked up in the exhibit hall last year at APHA. Sex feels so good, why do I feel so bad? I like the one with the gun in the middle. Are you playing sexual roulette? And my kids actually like the one on the right. Oral Sex, the Scary Truth. I think they thought it had something to do with Halloween, though. So, anyway. Allison Lynn and I just published a paper looking at the accuracy of a more recent look at the accuracy of condom information in three of the commonly used curricula. And we found that they still contain many messages suggesting that condoms fail to protect against HIV or pregnancy. Many of them use, out-of-date references. They misrepresent the research. They may pick the highest failure rate from a particular study. They do funny things like compare HIV risk to pregnancy risk, even though they're calculated in very different ways. You get a percentage in both cases, but the percentages are not comparable. So, and there's lots of other faulty kinds of reasoning. So we suggested that it was not complete accurate, current or accurate medical knowledge about the effectiveness of condoms. Here's one example. Relying on condoms is like playing Russian roulette. Condoms do not prevent pregnancy, STDs, or AIDS. The longer one relies on them, the greater the chance of failure. Even if the method has a 90% chance of success the first time, repeated acts compound the failure rate in a young person's risk. The longer one relies on them, the probability increases that a condom will fail and the game's over. So, anyway. And this is my favorite. This is Speedy the Sperm. Speedy's the big guy there. And the little guy up in the upper right-hand corner is the human immunodeficiency virus. Okay, and since the HIV virus is smaller than a sperm and can infect you any day of the month, the failure rate of the condoms to prevent AIDS is logically much worse than the failure rate to prevent pregnancy. I mean, what does this imply? I mean, essentially it's implying that somehow there's pores in a condom. NIH condom report said that's not true, but anyway, okay. I think it's interesting to look at the language of the federal program and the curricula. You know, there's clearly a moral focus. It frequently uses value terms like chaste and virgin and promiscuous. It often frames abstinence as a personal or moral commitment. And the regulations say that a mutually faithful, monogamous relationship in the context of marriage is the expected standard of human sexual activity. So that's the Congress's opinion on what we should all be doing. Okay. There's a very interesting use of science in the federal program. So there's this certainty about the efficacy of abstinence. So you can hear repeated frequently this assertion that abstinence is 100% effective. Certainly abstinence intentions may be different than abstinence behavior. There's an assertion of medical facts throughout these curricula that it's often false. There's this denigration of condoms and contraceptive use and these fear of mixed methods. And I would even go as far as to suggest that many of the curriculum suggest there's a post-sex or certainly a post-extramarital sex syndrome similar to the abortion syndrome. So it causes major mental health problems, including depression. Okay. And I think these are some of the underlying assumptions that sex ed and access to contraception causes kids to have sex, that teaching about abstinence and protection is a mixed message, and describing the limitations of contraceptive methods helps kids stop having sex. So I think these are underlying premises. I don't think there's scientific data to support them. I think there's a good bit of evidence to suggest that they're not true. Okay, so there is a federal requirement for medical accuracy. It was passed in 2000 as part of the Public Health Service Act and requires medical accuracy when educational materials about STDs are created and distributed by the Department of Health and Human Services and grantees. This is, importantly, it doesn't define medical accuracy. And it's interesting, this was passed by social conservatives who thought CDC was pushing condoms and not looking at the full evidence. Okay, the states have gotten, though, into the business since 2000, and as of last spring, a year ago, 21 states had somehow required scientific or medical accuracy in some part of either sexuality or AIDS education In some cases, they've also required it in rape counseling regulations and other things. Interestingly, states often don't define it, often frequently do not define it as well, but there are seven states that did, Utah, California, New Mexico, New Jersey, Colorado, Iowa, and Washington. And again, some of these are in educational requirements, and some of these are in clinical counseling kinds of statutes. Okay, so what do they show? The common elements of these definitions are verification or support of research conducted under accepted scientific methods. That sounds pretty good. Publication in peer-reviewed journals and recognized as accurate and objective by mainstream professional organizations such as Academy of Pediatrics, ACOG, US, or perhaps CDC. So these are the common elements in all seven of the definitions. So this is the California. This was in the sexuality education regulations. Verified or let me not read it because I think this basically says the same thing except it spells out CDC. Okay. So that's the core. But interesting, a number of the other states added, I think, some other things. So New Mexico, New Jersey, and Iowa added an important qualifier. It's not just evidence, but it's the weight of research or the weight of evidence. And so that one needs to look to that. And then Iowans so far, it was, I guess somebody, the Iowans are radicals or something. They suggested it had to be complete information as well. And finally, Colorado, which has the most complicated statute, suggested linkage to social, behavioral, and biomedical theory, scientific theory, and then adaptation of programs that are evidence-based. Okay. Most of these are pretty good. I mean, they're not all complete, but when you put them all together, you get a pretty good law. So this is the New Jersey statute. Again, the words weight of research. This is Iowa, and it says complete, I think, in the first sentence, and I won't read the rest of it because they're fairly repetitive. And this is Colorado, which, again, has the most complicated set of things. I really like the use of scientific theory, so let me say something else about that. Okay. So So how important are these additional elements? I think consistency with scientific theory is a pretty good idea. We have this big fight in the public schools around evolution. So we have evolutionary theory, which gets equated with, what's it, creation science, as if creation science was somehow science. But so what's scientific theory? I would suggest it, you know, builds upon theories or paradigms, and it's more than just an accumulation of facts. So you can't just cherry-pick your facts and say you have a scientific theory. Theory has to relate to the whole body of information that's come before. One can challenge theory, one can challenge parts of theory based on evidence, but you can't have a theory that's inconsistent with the facts. So pseudoscience, which we see a lot of in this area, conveniently ignores this point. So they just create a new theory which looks to me more like an ideology. Okay. And then the notion of complete information. I think there's growing consensus on a right to information in this country, and that, you know, as many of your providers, you know, withholding life-saving information from a sexually active teens is ethically problematic. Adolescents need the logic goes that adolescents need information on ways to prevent these outcomes, that the principle of informed consent that suggests that persons should be given all the pertinent information. They need to make an informed choice. It shows up in human rights writing as this right to information. It's frequently cited in UN human rights documents. It was an important underpinning of the Cairo meeting in 94. And I don't know about your patients, but my patients expect they're going to get complete and accurate information from me, right? This isn't so radical, right? Okay. There are some other definitions, abstinence education community got very nervous about this, and they've begun to promulgate their own definitions. These The two the primary that have tried to do this is the Medical Institute on Sexual Health and the National Abstinence Leadership Council. But they have some very interesting language in here. So they talk about not all articles that appear in peer-reviewed journals or in a government or NGO website are medically accurate. So they're directly sort of challenging, if you will, the medical establishment or the public health establishment on this. And there's a set of missing elements. They don't talk about scientific consensus. They don't talk about recognition by mainstream agencies, in part because they are not mainstream agencies. And they don't talk about the weight of scientific evidence. Okay. So let me wrap up. Jeff Copeland, who's former CDC director, my old boss, suggested that, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, science, you know, is the foundation for public health work, and that should really drive policy making. And he suggested in the last few years we've had the sort of sequence running in reverse, so politics seems to be, you know, trumping public health, and it's actually corrupting science as it goes along. So anyway, let me sum up about medical accuracy. I think it's actually a welcome and helpful development in sexuality education and perhaps by extension to other areas of public health where we have social controversy. I think requiring a medical accuracy can clarify debates between scientists and ideological-driven groups. They don't want to be called not medically accurate, but often they are. A definition of medical accuracy may also be helpful to state and federal policymakers and perhaps even local practitioners. And understanding the scientific consensus process can prevent the manipulation of scientific uncertainty. Thank you.